Wasteland, A World in Permanent Crisis. Author, Robert D. Kaplan. Chapter 2, The Great Powers in Decline. Henry Adams was the bookish grandson of John Quincy Adams, the sixth President of the United States, and the great-grandson of John Adams, the second President of the United States. More an introvert than an extrovert, believing himself suited for an earlier, less hurly-burly age than the latter decades of the 19th century and the turn of the 20th century, Henry Adams turned away from the bruising political calling of his forebears and became an historian, best known for his posthumous autobiography, The Education of Henry Adams. A man of acute historical insight and descriptive abilities, he believed that the actual journey didn't matter, and that it is only the memory of such journeys, the lessons learned, that constitutes an education. The Education of Henry Adams is a work of great literature, written a bit sententiously in the third person, about a man grappling with the onrush of current events and their effects on him. A born elitist, Adams was too learned and skeptical to be a romantic. Yet his pen was lush. He found 19th century Washington a curiously bleak and half-finished place, white Greek temples in the abandoned gravel pits of a deserted Syrian city. Among Adams's many sharp intuitions in The Education, first printed privately in 1907, was one about the past and future of Europe in regard to Russia, which he had focused on while a private secretary to the U.S. ambassador in London. Naturally, Russia was a problem 10 times as difficult as Germany, he writes. The history of Europe for 200 years had accomplished little but to state one or two sides of the Russia problem. One's year of Berlin in youth had opened one's eyes to the Russia enigma and the fascinated horror it engendered. Adams goes on in this vein, essentially saying in the years before World War I that Europe's principal dilemma was and always would be Russia, a thing too big, too Byzantine, too Asiatic almost, to fit alongside the more neat and tidy democracies of Europe with their comparatively stronger institutions. Adams writes, the last and highest triumph of history would be, to his mind, the bringing of Russia into the Atlantic combine. The Education was published in 1918, the year of Adams's death, but as I said, it was printed privately in 1907, so that those words were written in the very first years of the 20th century. The long European war, lasting from 1914 to 1989, and including the interval of the Weimar Republic between World Wars I and II, would tragically bear out Adams's words about the centrality of Russia. Adams foresaw not just the immediate future but the century ahead and then some. Now, with the Ukraine war, we have truly returned to the groove of history, with Russia defining it, that Adams identified. It was a groove established in earnest in August 1914. Remember that the Napoleonic Wars, which culminated in the destruction of the French army as it retreated from Moscow in the winter of 1812, would be followed by almost a century of relative peace in Europe, owing to the treaties forged at the Congress of Vienna by the foreign ministers of Austria, France, and Great Britain, which established the post-Napoleonic security order. It was World War I that, at last, irrevocably shattered this continental arrangement of the great powers that had been fashioned by those three brilliant 19th-century diplomats Metternich, Talleyrand, and Castlereagh. For the many decades of peace that their realism had bequeathed to Europe had made the populations of the major European states ironically unrealistic about the nature of human affairs in an age of advancing technology, so that Europeans rushed into World War I in a fit of euphoria, thinking it would all be over in a few weeks. That illusion began to be shattered in August 1914, the first month of an industrial war that would last 4 years and kill some 20 million people. Arguably the greatest and most decisive battle of that month was, as we know, Tannenberg, identified by Alexander Solzhenitsyn as a signal military defeat for Russia that led, by a chain of events, to the end of the Romanov dynasty, the birth of the Soviet Union, and almost three quarters of a century of communism. The historian Barbara Tuchman, in her classic work The Guns of August, demonstrates how Tannenberg exposed the whole weakness of the Tsarist system, the inadequacy of training and materials, the incompetence of generals, the inefficiency of organization were laid bare by the battle. She might have been writing about the early part of the Ukraine war, such is the continuity in Russian history. She goes on, the Russian steamroller in which the Western Allies placed such hopes, which after their debacle on the Western Front was awaited even more anxiously, had fallen apart on the road as if it had been put together with pins. 2. Tannenberg, which pitted Germany against Russia in what is now Polish territory, because it so undermined the Tsarist regime, would shape the course of events in the 20th century in Europe and the world. As Adams had foretold, Russia was and would remain at the very center of things. Russia, in the interwar period, continued to shock the West as the wages of the Bolshevik Revolution accumulated, and as Lenin was succeeded by Stalin in 1924. The Holodomor, or Ukrainian terror famine, deliberately inflicted by the Bolshevik authorities in 1932-33, but with origins a few years earlier, killed roughly 4 million people, though estimates vary widely. I'll never forget reading in the mid-1980s the opening words of British poet and historian Robert Conquest's The Harvest of Sorrow, Soviet Collectivization and the Terror Famine. 50 years ago as I write these words, the Ukraine and the Ukrainian Cossack and other areas to its east, a stretch of territory with some 40 million inhabitants, was like one vast Belsen. A quarter of the rural population, men, women, and children, lay dead or dying, the rest in various stages of debilitation. At the same time, as at Belsen, well-fed squads of police or party officials supervised the victims. This was Stalin's so-called revolution from above, in which he crushed two elements inimical to the Soviet regime, the peasantry as a whole and the Ukrainian nation in particular. Stalin's depredations would of course continue and grow to include vast purges of his own Communist Party and the leadership of the Soviet military itself. This all put the Soviet Union, the Russian Empire, that is, so central to European destiny even as it was so fragile, in an extremely perilous state when Nazi Germany invaded Russia's heartland in June 1941, penetrating hundreds of miles to the outskirts of Moscow. Roughly 27 million Soviet citizens would die as a result. Yet, the Russians showed an ability to suffer that was beyond belief, and gradually pushed Hitler's forces all the way back to Berlin, grabbing the whole of the territory in Central Eastern Europe in the process. In this way, the Eastern Front, in terms of blood, suffering, and sheer military decisiveness, constituted the very pivot and proving ground of World War II. As the saying went, the British, by standing alone between the Nazi invasion of Poland in 1939 and Pearl Harbor in 1941, bought the free world time. The Americans provided the money and industrial might for the war. But it was the Russians, principally, who paid the blood price. The United States and Great Britain could not have won the war on their own. Stalin's policy of not a step back, was typical of his brutal determination, and actualized in the 1942-43 Battle of Stalingrad, in which frontline troops had right behind them special security units who would shoot any retreating soldier. 13,500 Soviet troops were executed by their own side during the fateful battle that turned the tide of World War II. 4. The 44-year-long Cold War that followed World War II continued the story of Russia as Europe's principal fact and unsolvable dilemma. The continent was split in two. The western half, under American economic and military influence, was free, prosperous, and democratic. The eastern half, under Soviet military and Communist Party influence, was repressed, poor, and despotic. Great Russia now stretched literally from the heart of Central Europe to the Pacific. Russia was more than just an enigma, as Adams had phrased it, but the power that made practically the whole of Europe an armed camp in the second half of the 20th century. Russia, rather than be absorbed into Adams's Atlantic combined, that is, into Western Europe, was doing the absorbing, of Central and Eastern Europe. The last and highest triumph of history would have to wait. Not that the Soviet bloc, as it became known, made for a uniform and unhappy whole. The differences within the Warsaw Pact were vast. I have youthful memories as a student and a young journalist traveling from the relative freedom of Poland and Hungary, with their more liberal forms of communism, to Stalinist Romania, where the regime was like a block of concrete upon the people's chest, and from the dark repression but deeply cultured lands of East Germany and Czechoslovakia to the Anatolian-like bleakness and poverty of rural Bulgaria. Nevertheless, this vast eastern half of the continent, stretching from Central Europe to the Balkans, despite its various national idiosyncrasies and different histories, did constitute a negative unity, owing to Soviet, Great Russian, domination. It was as if color had been bled out of the landscape, rendering it all black and white, like the tones of a photo negative. Meanwhile, the western half of the continent was swept upward in a dynamic post-war economic miracle, leading to a golden age of art and cinema in which prosperity and social safety nets were the happy results of the Americans footing the security bill. By contrast, Eastern Europe, that is, the political geography of the Soviet bloc, was fixed in a state of freeze-frame poverty, as if from an earlier age, marked by badly lit streets and grim, blockhouse apartment buildings. Thus was the footprint Russia had established in literally half of Europe, between the end of World War II in 1945 and the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. The Cold War's end marked a sudden and decisive victory for the West. This was the result of deep structural forces and the human agency principally of one man, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, who came to power in 1985, with American President Ronald Reagan and the Polish-born Pope John Paul II playing supporting roles. Gorbachev, in recognizing the profound economic and bureaucratic infirmities of the communist system, allowed free debate, glasnost, and attempts at dramatic reform, perestroika, even as he stopped propping up communist parties in Eastern Europe. The results were earthshaking. Within the space of merely a few weeks in the final months of 1989, every regime in the Warsaw Pact collapsed. Thereafter, Adams's warning went into remission for the first time since 1914, as the Russian Empire did what it had periodically done throughout its history, but not since before the birth of modernity that came with the Industrial Revolution, it virtually disintegrated in much of its heartland. Thus, there came an historical interruption in Adams's scenario of Russia's centrality to Europe, as the collapse of the Soviet Union under the strain of Gorbachev's reforms at the end of the Cold War rendered Russia politically and economically enfeebled for well over a decade, from 1989 into the early 2000s. Russia immediately became so preoccupied with its internal problems that it was no longer much of a factor to be considered. Of course, few at the time among Western elites thought of this new state of affairs as an interruption at all, since they considered it the birth of a new order, in which Russia would gradually be transformed into a benign democracy along Western lines. No historian or analyst captured the failure of the American elite imagination regarding Russia at this moment better than the late New York University professor Stephen F. Cohen, who documented the utterly naive Clinton administration policy to remake Russia in America's own image in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. During the 1990s, economic shock therapy was promised as the mechanism that would deliver a new capitalist and democratic system. Cohen explains that the planeloads of heavily credentialed Americans referred to as advisors, economists, financiers, academics including political scientists, and so on who descended on Russia with the Clinton administrations, were in truth political missionaries and evangelists. These people led the Washington Consensus on Russia, which was unfailingly hopeful about the rule of Boris Yeltsin, who succeeded Gorbachev. Optimism prevails universally among those who are familiar with what is going on in Russia, declared Vice President Al Gore in 1998. But by abruptly inflicting an unadulterated capitalism upon a creaky, barely Western, and crumbling communist system that had ruled for decades across 11 time zones, these experts perpetrated the worst American foreign policy disaster since Vietnam. With consequences more long-term and perilous, according to Cohen. For as we now know, this misconceived policy, by helping to foster institutional chaos and a precipitous collapse of living standards, opened a void in governance that would eventually be filled by Vladimir Putin's ultimately disastrous rule. Indeed, the Russian currency collapsed. Deregulation of prices led to inflation of more than 200%. State companies and other assets were sold off at cut-rate prices to what would become a new class of oligarchs. Consequently, democracy, writes Stephen Lee Myers, a Russia correspondent for the New York Times, had taken root in barren soil. 6. Geopolitically, Russia's collapse in the 1990s, thanks in part to America's misguided help, led to an unprecedentedly benign environment in the former Eastern Europe, as a number of countries of the former Warsaw Pact joined NATO. Russia didn't like it, but was too weak to do anything about it. Truly, Adams's Russia problem and enigma seemed to have evaporated for the time being. People continue to debate whether it was wise for NATO to expand eastward, but the dramatic and sudden victory of the West in the Cold War probably made the expansion inevitable. Thus, in the 1990s and 2000s, the West had free rein throughout Europe, as not only NATO but the European Union, too, expanded to the east. In this climate, NATO's military interventions in 1995 in Bosnia and in 1999 in Kosovo only transpired as they did because of Russian weakness. Had Russia remained powerful in the 1990s, it would have been able to negotiate the terms of Western intervention in the Balkans, where Russian influence, especially among the Slavs of Greater Serbia, has historically been undeniable. It was abject Russian weakness, and the fact that China's great navy would not really emerge for another decade, that allowed Western journalists and intellectuals in the last decade of the 20th century to believe that liberal democracy was in the process of taking over the world, shepherded by an America unchallenged by any real competitor. Military power thus became subsumed by humanitarian concerns, as the moral compromises necessitated by great power politics had vanished with the end of the Cold War, or so it seemed. Thus, the 1990s were a break from rather than the end of history, so to speak. All this shaped the international context for the Al-Qaeda attacks of September 11, 2001, and the response to them. Because no great power threat loomed at that moment, it was naturally assumed that Islamic terrorism had now become the principal strategic challenge, in what the George W. Bush administration went on to call the global war on terrorism. After all, the ultimate security threat had been realized, the United States had been attacked on its own soil in a dramatic fashion with substantial loss of life for the first time since the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, which had led to America's entry into World War II. The subsequent invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, when looked at from a dispassionate distance, originated not with the urge to remake Middle Eastern countries into democracies but with the demand for absolute security, even beyond what the weakening of Russia in the 1990s had achieved. Democracy building would come later and was subsidiary to the elemental fear among key policymakers of more attacks emanating from the Middle East. The invasion of Iraq, to say nothing of Afghanistan, simply never would have occurred without 9/11, which further diverted us from great power politics. For the fear of more terrorist attacks in those first years of the new century was vivid and all-consuming. The intensity of the present moment, the unreal televised image of the Twin Towers collapsing, had blotted out any thought of the past or future. This is something that will become more common as communications technology marches on, making us less rather than more aware of the pitfalls and disasters ahead. Technology will increasingly deify the present by making it more vivid and overpowering, thus undermining our sense of history, which is an awareness of the past and future. And that was a factor in the immediate months and years following 9/11, and in the weeks and months following the October 7, 2023, Hamas attack on Israel. Yet, as it would turn out, after all of the drama, 9/11 proved to be a head fake, a far-reaching distraction as Russian President Vladimir Putin methodically rebuilt the Russian state with the help of the military and intelligence services, and as China, especially under the leadership of Xi Jinping, eventually emerged as an aggressive military, economic, and technological power. Obviously, we know all this only in hindsight. At the time, relatively few analysts, Cohn Gray was an exception, discerned the grand pattern of the future, and they were not listened to. Alas, by the second decade of the 21st century it had become apparent that the Afghanistan and Iraq wars, Far-flung imperial enterprises both, had substantially weakened the United States and given its adversaries a head start in the renewed strategic competition. Of course, even as I write, we may be missing yet another grand pattern of history to which the cinematic vividness of the Ukraine and Gaza wars now blind us, for example, a future combination of great power conflict, periodic terrorist attacks, and cyber warfare integrated with the use of artificial intelligence, which will add new dimensions and uncertainties to warfare. We still have little idea, given the march of post-industrial technology, what future great power warfare could be like, just as in the decades following the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-71 few had any idea what future industrial war would be like. The problem with predicting the future is that it usually descends into linear thinking, the mere extension of current trends. That's why the best futurology may be a description of an aspect of the present that is ignored by the media and beyond the conventional reach of the television cameras. Indeed, Russia's sweeping, monumental military attack on Ukraine, bringing Adams's theory of European history back with a vengeance, had its roots in such relative obscurity. For years and decades, as we know, Putin intervened in one place after another in the Caucasus and Black Sea region, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Georgia, Crimea, and so on, while the media was occupied elsewhere, obsessively covering the anarchy in Syria, where Russia was also militarily involved, and the related war against the Islamic State. Then, in 2014, Putin began a proxy war in eastern Ukraine. Yet this and the other conflicts in which Russia was involved in the former Soviet Union energized policy elites only in Washington and New York, who had cried out, to no avail, for stopping Putin in his tracks. Those conflicts left only a weak imprint on people's minds in the West, since with their obscure geography and exotic place names, such locales appeared to be of relatively minor consequence, faraway countries of which we know little. To paraphrase British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's comment about why he conceded the Sudetenland to Hitler at Munich. And, in a manner similar to Hitler's, Putin, having encountered only minor Western responses to those earlier forays, kept pushing into what he conceived of as a vacuum of American and European will. Then, in February 2022, with the Russian bombardment of Ukrainian cities and other civilian areas that would continue for months, with vast tank columns now on the move, thousands killed, and more than 10 million refugees and displaced persons, it was suddenly clear that we were now in a new world, or a very old world, frankly, with the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq consigned in our minds to a distant, even older imperial past and loop of history, like Vietnam. Ironically, the Biden administration's shambolic withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021 may have encouraged Putin's plan for invading Ukraine, out of the belief that America and the West were impotent. The Afghanistan failure may also have forced the Biden administration to pull together bureaucratically for the sake of future crises. Without the messy Afghanistan withdrawal, that is, the administration may not have performed as well as it did in the early part of the Ukraine war. History is full of such ironies. Russia's invasion of Ukraine suddenly made World War II, though 8 decades removed, feel much closer in time, as there had been nothing comparable to this in Europe since the Allied destruction of Berlin in 1945. Yes, we were firmly back in the groove of history, as Henry Adams had defined it. Russia was still, and more so than ever, the defining problem for Europe. By comparison, the wars in the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia, with which an entire generation of elite journalists was obsessed, had involved only small states that were not nuclear powers, and as brutal as the fighting was and as horrific as the war crimes were, these wars still did not compare with Ukraine in terms of the scope of destruction. Whereas the United States intervened in the Balkans out of ideals and after the serious fighting had ground down to a stalemate, it intervened in Ukraine with masses of cutting-edge weaponry for the most strategic and geopolitical of purposes, to bodily weaken another great power. The Balkans was an elite war, that is, the public was not emotionally captured by it. Ukraine, by contrast, has been a subject that broad swaths of the American public have opinions about, especially when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Washington and addressed Congress in December 2022. Of such magnitude is the Ukraine war that more months of fighting there could affect Europe and Eurasia for years and decades to come. The progress of the war, in which a country of 44 million people has had at times the military advantage over a nuclear power of 143 million, has exposed the Russian Empire as the sick man of Eurasia, just as the Ottoman Empire was for decades the sick man of Europe before it collapsed in World War I. The Ukraine war, though it has exposed Russian military limits, of which I will have more to say, nevertheless also demonstrated that there is and has been no world order or international community, no rules-based system in Europe or anywhere else, the more one reflects upon it. The Gaza war has offered another punctuation of this. Different parts of the world were simply determined by their own balance of power systems that, because they usually held up well, were mistaken for a rules-based order that was in fact nowhere in evidence. As the Catholic University professor Jacob Grigiel put it, an earth-spanning security space governed by global rules doesn't exist. Instead, there are only regional equilibria with their own military dynamics driven by local historical competitions. 7. Russia and Ukraine had represented one such regional equilibrium, in which a relatively low level of violence in eastern Ukraine, perpetrated by Russia for a few years, along with the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014, never really made a significant impact on the Western consciousness. And thus the situation in the mind of many was considered stable. But February 24, 2022, the day that columns of Russian tanks crossed into Ukraine, overturned that notion. It demonstrated not just how mass violence perpetrated by major states was once again possible in Europe, but how the previous decades in Europe, during the Cold War and afterward, constituted not peace but an armed truce. It also provided a warning that other parts of the globe were less stable than we thought. Hamas's ferocious attacks on Israeli civilians, including women and children, and Israel's brute force response are signs of how primitive forces are more vivid than the watered-down resolutions regularly emanating from groups like the United Nations and the G20 about this and that, because they demonstrate how our world is still one of pitiless power struggles that make a mockery of elite posturing. Think of it, the other places where equilibria currently hold but which could crumble or explode. China's stated but as yet unrealized determination to conquer Taiwan, by force if necessary, tense naval standoffs in the South and East China Seas, Iran's determination to acquire a nuclear arsenal, coupled with its precision-guided missiles aimed at Saudi and other Arab Gulf oil facilities, to say nothing of its network of proxy forces and terrorist insurgents facing off against a de facto Israeli, Sunni Arab alliance in the Middle East, these are just the broad areas of concern beyond Russia. And Europe, where, by the way, the continuation of the Ukraine war threatens to begin unraveling the whole Russian Empire and its shadow lands from the Caucasus to Siberia and the Far East. Farther afield, there are the perennial India-Pakistan nuclear and conventional military standoffs, the real chance of war on the Korean Peninsula, and the rising tensions between Egypt and Ethiopia regarding water allocations after the building of a new dam on the Blue Nile. Then there are all the anarchic conflicts and vast refugee migrations in Central America and Sub-Saharan Africa that receive little or no media attention. This is certainly not a world governed by a rules-based order, as polite gatherings of the global elite like to define it, but rather a world of broad, overlapping areas of tension, raw intimidation, and military standoffs. Indeed, there is no night watchman to keep the peace in this brawling, tumultuous world defined by upheaval. As for the United Nations, it has mainly degenerated into a talk shop more important to the global elite itself than to the world at large. Sadly, the UN seems to be disappearing before our eyes. In the early television age, especially in black and white, it was a place of high Cold War drama that at least transfixed the American public, so that the UN mattered somewhat. Back then the UN exposed the world's deep ideological divisions but also its fervent hopes for peace arising from the end of World War II. In the early 1960s there was Cuban leader Fidel Castro in his jungle fatigues, speaking at the podium for hours, and Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, shoe in hand, in a rage before the General Assembly, defending the communist system. Later on, when color was beginning to replace black and white, there was the elegance of Israeli Foreign Minister Abba Eban defending his country's attack on neighboring Arab states in the Six-Day War of 1967. In the mid-1970s, there was the oratory of U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Daniel Patrick Moynihan denouncing the General Assembly's Zionism is racism resolution. The theatrical quality still exists at the UN, but it isn't what it used to be, and the institution matters less, as there is just too much going on in the media elsewhere, and the UN has always been largely about performance politics. That's why secretary generals of late are less well known than in the past. Dag Hammarskjöld, Uth Ant, Kurt Waldheim, and Kofi Annan, for better or worse, were more in the public eye than Ban Ki-moon and Antonio Guterres. There is just something antiquated about the UN, maybe because it represents a post-World War II division of power, in which France is a member of the Security Council, but India, a key global pivot state maneuvering among the great powers, is not. The Ukraine war also has hurt the UN, since it reflects a world of hard military power where states do as they please as opposed to the UN's feckless soft power. The Security Council seems even less relevant with Russia still a member, even as India, again, is not. Throughout the Cold War, remember, the Soviet Union was seen as a legitimate member of the Security Council, having been a World War II ally, in command of a bloc of states, and not directly launching major wars. The Security Council always sort of worked as long as its members were not actually at war with one another. But for the first time since the UN's creation in 1945, two members were on opposite sides of a big, hot war in Europe. The UN has always handled issues in the former Third World that the major powers deem as secondary while formalizing what the major powers have previously agreed upon. But it did so with the assumption of a rules-based order that hopefully would come into being. Now that seems more unlikely than ever. The United Nations, though it seeks to both preserve and make peace among nations, ironically can only prosper if such a peace is already to some extent in existence, so that a world of great powers on the edge of war leaves the UN diminished. The raw violence of the Israel-Gaza conflict, the ethnic cleansing of the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, the gun battles between Albanians and ethnic Serbs in Kosovo, and the trench warfare in Ukraine all manifest a reality far more vivid than the United Nations and groups like the G20 with their watered-down, sanctimonious resolutions represent. As for globalization, the UN did once give us a glimpse of a global world, but lately it has been superseded by the very messy reality of globalization itself. Globalization, which is based on trade, the large-scale movement of people by jet transportation, and rapid technological advances in the electronic and digital realms, fits neatly together with a world in permanent crisis. That is because the permanent crisis demands a dense webwork of interactions between crisis zones across the earth, which globalization produces. Ukraine, Gaza, and other major wars have their effects amplified, rather than assuaged, by globalization. A Weimar-type world, in the sense that I mean it, would be impossible without globalization. Globalization can thus far be divided into two broad phases, which I will label Globalization 1.0 and Globalization 2.0, with the coronavirus functioning as a very rough chapter break between them. At the end of the Cold War, remember, there was for all intents and purposes no internet, no email, no smartphones, no well-established global elite with its influential networks and conferences, none of the things we now take for granted as the staples of our interconnected world. All of that came about in the context of a world which, in a security sense, was initially united by a U.S. unipolar hegemon, as America's ideological victory against Soviet communism led, in the 1990s, to postmodern capitalism and American management practices spreading across the globe, creating gleaming new cities in previously sleepy or at least undervalued places such as Bangalore, Baku, Hanoi, all the capitals of the Arabian Gulf, and so on. Suddenly, World cities looked increasingly similar and similarly prosperous, and people were flying to places they never did before. Silicon Valley, which relies heavily on computer engineers and software writers from places as diverse as India, Israel, and Russia, could not have become the phenomenon that it did except in a post-Cold War world. This explosion of economic and technological creativity gave rise to Globalization 1.0. Globalization 1.0 was basically a good news story, so that in its time the heady 1990s globalization was actually mistaken for a wholesale security arrangement ensuring a Kantian universal peace of sorts, even as minor wars proliferated here and there. Besides the prodigious evolution of technology, Globalization 1.0 was about the spread of democracy and the creation and enlargement of middle classes beyond the West and particularly in formerly communist Central Europe. It was also about the dismantling of thermonuclear arsenals in the United States and the former Soviet Union, about the eradication of a good deal of the extreme poverty in the former Third World, and about the rise of an integrated system of global stock markets, together with a plethora of new global corporations with international and multilingual boards and staffs. Truly, a global elite now seemed to be in charge, claiming to engineer reality from above and throughout the world by virtue of the fancy conferences it held such as in Davos, Aspen, and Bilderberg. Progress was seen as automatic, linear, and deterministic, and consequently the sense of the tragic was lost. Again, there was an affliction of presentness, as if the present in all of its vividness, enhanced and constantly improved upon by technology, could go on forever and just keep getting better. The Cold War, with its deep and entrenched great power divisions, seemed to have occurred decades ago rather than a few years ago. And because a difficult past had been virtually forgotten by America's sudden and unexpected victory in the Cold War, there was no sense of a difficult future either. The 1990s ended late, on September 11, 2001. It was stunning how quickly a mood can change. One day all the smart people were saying that geopolitics had been replaced by geoeconomics in this new era of perpetual peace, a la the philosopher Immanuel Kant, and exactly as Bill Clinton had believed very early in his presidency. The next day it was all about terrorism and going to war against the bad guys. One day George W. Bush was seen as just fine as president. The next day there was the question of, is he up to the job? After all, as one prominent Republican told me, had we still been in a situation like the Cold War before the 2000 election, the party elders would have gently told Father Bush that his son had good prospects but needed more experience and seasoning. The younger Bush was picked between the end of the Cold War and 9/11, when nothing serious seemed at stake. The 9/11 attacks were quickly followed by the American invasion of Afghanistan, and 17 months later by the Iraq War. The Greater Middle East now consumed our strategic and historical thinking. But meanwhile, the Chinese were methodically constructing a gargantuan, high-end military complex, with an emphasis on warships, fighter jets, missiles, and cyber warfare capabilities. In time, they would be perfecting the art of turning technology to Orwellian purposes, snooping on the online searches of untold millions of their citizens to determine their loyalty to the state, and in the process complicating the techno-optimism that had raged in the West. At this time, while America remained obsessed with the Middle East, Vladimir Putin was also methodically beginning to stabilize Russia through a blend of authoritarianism and organized crime networks, following the chaos of the Yeltsin years with their failed experiment in democracy. This also began a period when social and economic anxieties began to permeate the new globe-spanning middle classes that had been the creation of Globalization 1.0, resulting in the gradual rise of populism and new forms of authoritarianism in a number of countries in the West and the former Third World. Whether it was the strengthening of a nasty right-wing movement in France or Hungary, or Brazil, or Turkey, or wherever, encouragement always seemed to flow from Putin's newly risen Russia. Evidently, the contraction of the world system had helped allow not only for the spread of good trends, but for bad ones as well. Globalization 2.0 was upon us, and it wasn't altogether a good news story. COVID-19, which to a significant extent shut down the world economy, struck at the end of 2019, and its effects lingered for a number of years. As the world emerged from COVID-19, globalization, which had dramatically helped spread the virus, did not look so benign. Average readers like chapter breaks, and COVID-19 was a convenient if very imperfect chapter break between Globalization 1.0 and Globalization 2.0. We were now in a new world, and globalization seemed a distinctly value-neutral historical development, as good as it was bad, and in fact central to the permanent, Weimar-like crisis I have been describing. A world united was also a world where there was no place to hide. The belief that a smaller world would necessarily be a better world was fundamentally flawed, since it assumed an inherent goodness in the fact of proximity, which is often not the case. After all, we periodically don't get along with our next-door neighbors. Countries have military clashes along their borders. Disease does not respect borders. Because of these and many other examples, we often yearn for separation and quietude. One of the reasons America is powerful is that it is protected by oceans. And one of the reasons why Americans have become less secure is because oceans offer them less protection than they used to. Once again, the finite Earth is gradually losing the race against technology and population growth, as John von Neumann indicated. COVID-19 spread as far and as rapidly as it did because of this phenomenon. COVID-19 might actually have been a minor factor in Putin's decision to invade Ukraine, since it increased his isolation from other people, which left him more often alone with his own thoughts. Both the virus and the Ukraine war, by the way, each in its own fashion, disrupted supply chains, contributing to an element of deglobalization, however short-lived it was. It is just that because everything intersects with everything else in a smaller world, such a world is by definition unstable. Journalists began to record an unending series of cataclysms, COVID-19 and massive lockdowns, the murder by Minneapolis police of the African American George Floyd and ensuing urban riots and protests, the January 6, 2021, Capitol insurrection as the capstone of the nonstop crises of the Trump presidency, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the partial rearming of Europe, the Chinese crackdown on Hong Kong coupled with Beijing's intensifying military threat to Taiwan, the Gaza war following the Hamas attack on Israel, and so forth all added to the crises on the international scene. History had marched on, with domestic events interwoven with world events, and no time to catch one's breath. And it was real history, for each of those events' effect on society and geopolitics was profound. The George Floyd murder changed our ideas about race and the American past. It even changed our language and how we were supposed to express ourselves. The Trump presidency from 2017 to 2021 made us question the very viability of American democracy and political order. The Ukraine war made us fear the very thing we had thought we had left behind many decades before, a conventional military conflict between the great powers. Humanity's new sense of claustrophobia, wrought by the closing of distance, which was in turn wrought by technology, was in and of itself intensifying the magnitude of each crisis as it was perceived. The hot medium of digital video communications drove us into emotional, philosophical, and ideological silos much more than did the cool, gray medium of print and typewriter journalism. Journalists shoved their opinions in our faces in a way that was harder to do with the old technology. They were participants, taking sides in a way they never used to do, which only served to further intensify everything we thought and heard. We all felt we were down in the arena as well as watching from the stands. Personal life has its escalating anxieties, to be sure, but public life had become unbearable. It used to be in years and decades past that the most combative political arguments were about the Middle East, which quickly descended into an us versus them mentality. You were either for the Jews or for the Arabs. Now the whole world and much of public life has become as confrontational as the Middle East. That is the totemic reality of globalization. Enmeshed in the tumult of globalization, with all of its mayhem, are the great powers, on which a semblance of world order depends, all of which are experiencing grave difficulties. Whatever the state of upheaval in America, the fact is that Russia and China are experiencing something deeper and more fundamental. Let me start, though, with America and Russia. In the first quarter of the 21st century, two of the three great powers, the United States and Russia, initiated truly unnecessary and disastrous wars of choice, the United States in Iraq and Russia in Ukraine. We might also add the American war in Afghanistan, which started out well in the fall of 2001 with tactical ingenuity and an economy of military force, but which quickly transformed into a two-decade-long occupation by a big, creaky U.S. Army bureaucracy, something completely unsuited for a sprawling, mountainous, and underdeveloped country. The point is, national power itself, which is derivative of geographical position, natural resources, and economic strength, is ultimately dependent on the good judgment of leaders, not all of the time, but most of the time, and especially when key decisions are required that can constitute historical hinges. The wars in Iraq and Ukraine show the dearth of wise and cautious leadership, not just in the United States after the end of the Cold War, but in Russia as well, as Soviet leaders from Leonid Brezhnev to Mikhail Gorbachev were on the whole far wiser and more cautious than Putin. Indeed, leadership is vital to a great power or empire. It constitutes the Shakespearean element that ultimately eclipses the vast impersonal forces of geopolitical and economic fate. That is why China's leader Xi Jinping's obsession with absorbing or even conquering Taiwan might indicate that not only the United States and Russia, but China, too, face over the long term what I call Shakespearean decline. I refer to the inner demons that drive all powerful leaders to a certain degree of madness, best exemplified in some of the plays of Shakespeare. It is uncanny, as if all three great powers have produced leaders with a death wish, each driven by private torments. And the more concentrated and unchallenged their individual power, the greater their proclivity to do real damage to the worldwide geopolitical equilibrium. Of course, the mistakes of American and Russian leaders have not been of the same magnitude, even as in China's case we can't be sure, as a military conflict over Taiwan may still lie in the future. For example, the Iraq War begun by President George W. Bush was never as central to America's declining reputation for power in the first two decades of the 21st century as the Ukraine War was to Russia's declining reputation for judgment and safeguarding its far-flung empire in the century's third decade. Iraq, however much it dominated news coverage in the early and mid-2000s, and however vast the civilian and military carnage, more than 7,000 American troops and civilian contractors dead and 35,000 seriously wounded, in addition to hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians killed, was at the end of the day a far-flung imperial adventure gone awry, from which the United States managed to recover, as callous as that sounds. Iraq certainly contributed to the malaise among Republicans and the nation at large that culminated in the election of Donald Trump as president in 2016. The soldiers and Marines from blue-collar families who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, who I can attest as an embedded war reporter, were originally enthusiastic about the prospects of victory, in significant measure turned to Trump following the abject failure of both wars, something which became undeniably apparent around the beginning of the century's second decade. Yet the failure of the Iraq War was never truly central to Trump's election, not nearly as central as was the outsourcing of well-paying manufacturing jobs to China and other developing countries, the further job-killing effects of automation, the anemic growth of the American economy in the years before Trump's victory, or general cultural issues that occupied the media and obviously played a significant role. Through it all, Iraq was just not as important to America's geopolitical identity as Ukraine has been to Russia's. But Iraq mattered in another, more subtle way. It was the most clear-cut example of the general deterioration in the quality of American leadership since the end of the Cold War. Even considering the Biden administration's middling competent handling of the Ukraine war thus far, the record of presidential leadership in foreign policy from Harry Truman to George H.W. Bush, and including Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan, was of a much higher caliber than from Bill Clinton to the current occupant of the White House, and including George W. Bush and Donald Trump. The difference between Cold War presidential leadership and post-Cold War presidential leadership might have been even greater had John F. Kennedy not been assassinated in November 1963. Kennedy, a wealthy, confident, genuine World War II hero who was extremely well-read in foreign affairs, would likely not have swallowed wholesale the advice of the Pentagon to greatly expand the Vietnam War, exactly as President Lyndon Johnson, a foreign policy neophyte, did, in fact, do in 1965. Such a palpable decline from one group to another, despite individual variations, was related to a decay in the culture of public life, especially the media, in which the forces acting upon all of these men had become more divisive, intolerant, and even hysterical at times. And as the media has become less serious, so have our leaders. The media, with its right and left wing extremes, each seeking to proclaim its virtue in its own way, has often encouraged our post-Cold War presidents to be moralistic rather than moral. Passion, often the enemy of analysis, is precisely what is encouraged by social media, which has had such an insidious effect on our politics. To some extent, nations, especially in democracies, get the leaders they deserve. America was a great and well-functioning mass democracy in the print and typewriter age. It is unclear whether it can continue as such in a digital video age aggravated by social media, which promises to be further manipulated by artificial intelligence. I will go into American society in far more detail in the third and last part of this book. For now, suffice it to say that America's weakness and its capacity to decline is rather subtle, that is, unrelated to fundamental structural forces, geography, for instance. It may be in decline, but it remains a powerful behemoth. After all, America is bordered on two sides by great oceans and a thin band of middle-class civilization in Canada to its north. Its only problematic border is with Mexico to its south. Furthermore, America has been united by the Mississippi, Missouri, and Ohio River systems, which allows goods to travel from one end of the continent to the other, in turn allowing for a vast internal market to develop. Meanwhile, China has a long border with an historical enemy to the north, Russia, and to the south with historical enemies India and Vietnam. In the east, China faces a veritable maritime wall of hostile, pro-American states. As for Russia, its northern coastline is ice-blocked much of the year, and it sprawls across half the longitudes of the earth without properly placed river systems such as America's to internally connect it, and without natural borders such as seas and mountains to protect it from invasion, and that is at the root of Russian insecurity that has driven it to be overly aggressive. America is not only geographically blessed, but technologically superior to China even, because of its free society and consequent tradition of inquiry and risk-taking. It is America's political, social, and cultural divisions that have taken their toll on the country's political leadership, and that's even if Donald Trump passes from the scene. In sum, American society is clearly engaged in a continuing partisan war of sorts, though one mainly without the shooting. Indeed, the United States has come a long way in terms of becoming more divided since, as a six-year-old boy in 1958, I watched a liberal crowd on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn cheering wizened veterans of the imperialist Spanish-American War of 1898, one of my most vivid early childhood memories. A few years later, the Vietnam War would tear asunder American society's unity and cause a large segment of the public to lose its trust in government, a trust that had been nurtured by the successes of the New Deal, World War II, and the space program. But as I said, I will deal with America's social and political pathologies later. The decline of Russia is on a different scale entirely. For two decades, as Vladimir Putin restored Russia to great power status following the debacle of the end of the Cold War and the disintegration of the Soviet Union, he became increasingly dangerous, autocratic, and, in fact, outright vicious, demonstrated by, among other things, the grisly poisoning of several Russian dissidents. Putin initiated frozen wars, that is, permanent military conflicts and standoffs throughout Ukraine and the Caucasus. He murdered and otherwise destroyed adversaries in Russian society, of which the poisonings were but examples. and he rebuilt Russia's military and security complex, with a nasty tendency to initiate cyber attacks in the West. But all of this was on a rather small scale. Meanwhile, he had relatively cheap, high-quality natural gas to sell to NATO countries, particularly Germany. Germany was central to Putin's strategy. Germany, which boasted the most powerful economy and manufacturing base in Europe, had, as we know, a long and sorry history with Russia. Its panoramic Eastern Front with Russia was exceedingly bloody in World War I. And in World War II, the Eastern Front constituted far and away the bloodiest contest in the entire European theater. To repeat, roughly 27 million Soviets died during World War II fighting Nazi Germany. The Battle of Stalingrad alone, which turned the tide of the war against Hitler, accounted for roughly 2 million German and Soviet casualties. As the British historian Anthony Beaver recounts, the vast fields of the dead and dying at Stalingrad, afflicted by starvation, frostbite, lice, forced marches, and executions, might even be compared to the sufferings at Nazi concentration camps. Then came the Cold War, when sheer Russian military power split Germany in half. East Germany was by and large an artificial communist state occupied by the Soviet army. With this traumatic history, Germans in the early 21st century desperately wanted a normal relationship with Russia. In fact, Ostpolitik, the West German policy of normalizing relations with communist East Germany and the rest of the East Bloc in the late 1960s and the 1970s had an elemental theme of reaching out to the Soviet Union, the Russian Communist Empire, in order to assuage this difficult history. Simply put, no German wanted another war in the East. Russian natural gas, transported by pipelines to Germany and the rest of Central Eastern Europe from Siberian fields, seemed to offer a convenient and profitable solution to this historical dilemma. Russian gas, it was believed, would solve Germany's energy needs while also forging a stable, even friendly, relationship between Germany and Russia. Gas deals with Russia made the German political establishment feel good about itself, since the deals would prevent another war in Europe, even as they helped make Germany and key members of its establishment extraordinarily wealthy. This is why the German establishment supported former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's acceptance of lucrative and high executive positions in Russian energy companies, such as Nord Stream AG, Rosneft, and Gazprom. Think of it, a former German chancellor, the equivalent of a former US president, taking top positions in the energy firms of a dictatorship and rival great power. Schröder could only have done this with the approval of the chancellor at the time, Angela Merkel. Merkel, from Germany's main right-of-center party, the Christian Democratic Union, and Schröder, from the main left-of-center party, the Social Democrats, effectively forged a political alliance based on Russian gas that took Germany in a neutralist strategic direction located between NATO and Russia, even as Germany was a member of NATO with the United States effectively paying for its defense. It was a good deal if you could get it. And Germany did. There was only one issue, Vladimir Putin himself. The whole German strategy that Merkel and her predecessor Schröder had bought into was based on an assessment of Putin being rational and dependable at the end of the day, that is to say, despite his being aggressive, nasty, and troublesome, they assumed he would not blow up Europe. His annexation of Crimea and launching of an unconventional small war in eastern Ukraine in 2014, coupled with the poisoning of his principal enemies, was worrying, surely. But as long as he did not do something like launch a major land war, you could do business with him, or so the German political and economic establishment essentially thought. It would turn out that this calculated risk and assessment of one man was dead wrong. While all this was going on, while Putin entrapped Germany as well as other countries in Europe with Russian natural gas, he also divided them by encouraging European populist leaders such as Hungary's Viktor Orban and France's Marine Le Pen, leaders who, like Putin himself, believed in the reality of the ethnic nation above that of the individual. Given all this, Putin believed that a quick and successful invasion of Ukraine would forge a permanent alliance with a weakened and insecure Germany, practically dislodging it from the West, which would have the indirect effect of further undermining Europe's other liberal democracies. Splitting Europe was clearly in Putin's interest, as he defined it. It was only a matter of a successful or even just a partially successful invasion of Ukraine that could be over in a matter of weeks with relatively little bloodshed. Putin's decision to invade Ukraine was not as mad as it seems. In the years and decade or two prior to his invasion, he had successfully intervened in Syria, South Ossetia, and so on, where he learned a different lesson than what George W. Bush had learned in Iraq. What Putin thought he learned was that wars could actually be fought cheaply and successfully. Indeed, in those wars, as well as in Russia's mercenary operations in sub-Saharan Africa, relatively small and professionalized units had been involved, given to discipline, proper training, and reasonably high morale. As for Syria, Russia intervened mostly in the air. Thus it must have seemed to Putin that he had successfully modernized Russia's military following the collapse of the Soviet Union the generation before. But just as the German political and economic establishment misread Putin, Putin misread Ukraine. History, among other things, is a record of such miscalculations. Most famously, perhaps, European leaders in the early and mid-1930s misread Hitler, and Hitler, following a streak of successful military aggressions, misread the difficulty of conquering the Soviet Union. In a similar vein, Ukraine overturned the notion of Putin's own successful streak of military interventions. This is not to draw a comparison between Hitler and Putin, who are vastly different men, only to suggest that history in a very broad sense can follow similar patterns. Ukraine overturned Putin's notion of his own invincibility. Because he now attempted a war of scale in a large country, not only were special forces and mercenaries involved, but mainly large numbers of conventional troops and tank units. Suddenly, for the first time in the record of Putin's military adventures, combined arms, that is, coordination between air, land, and sea forces, as well as a realistic strategy befitting a World War II size campaign, were all required. And that, in turn, meant logistics, coordinating the supply of fuel, food, spare parts, maintenance units, ammunition, and what have you for a large, advancing army separated into a half dozen principal paths of advance. As it turned out, none of those elements was in evidence in the initial Russian aggression against Ukraine. Several years of embedding with U.S. ground forces during the global war on terrorism had taught me that a First World Army is built around its NCO Corps, the various types of sergeants, corporals, and other non-commissioned officers who impose pride and discipline on the thousands of troops. Officers devise policy and plans, NCOs carry them out. Military culture depends far more on NCOs than on officers. The Russian military that Putin sent into Ukraine barely had an NCO corps. With the special forces units who had fought Russia's small wars, that hadn't mattered much. The Wagner Group in the Middle East and Africa and the Little Green Men in eastern Ukraine were mercenaries by another name. But with the large conventional force that Russia sent into Ukraine, the absence of a strong and competent NCO corps was everything. This was why a relatively large number of Russian generals were killed early in the war, after all, rather than remain in the rear directing large-scale movements as in a Western army, they were forward and consequently vulnerable because there were not enough empowered lower-level officers and NCOs to carry out their orders. A First World Army, the product of Western democracy, decentralizes decision-making down through the ranks. A Third World Army, especially if it is a product of a communist Soviet legacy, does not. Russia's did not. Moreover, the old Russian demons from decades and centuries past of land warfare now reasserted themselves. The Russians were less an army than a mob on the move. This had always been the case. For example, Nancy Mitford, in her biography of Frederick the Great, writes that whereas it was reckoned that in one campaign in 1759, the Prussian military burnt some 1,000 civilian houses, the Russians burnt about 1,000. There was, too, to cite another odd but telling example from a history of depredations, Stalin's treatment of the ethnic German civilians outside Germany at the end of World War II. The Soviets deported and conscripted hundreds of thousands of these people for forced labor, considering this awful deed fair reparations for Germany's invasion of the Soviet Union. A leadership that could perpetrate show trials of imagined political enemies and enlarge a czarist penal system into an archipelago of forced labor camps known as the Gulag, in which between 1 and 2 million inmates died, could easily perpetrate such secondary crimes as those against the ethnic Germans. Putin's rule has terrifying antecedents from which, it turns out, it cannot wholly be divorced. Just how terrifying these antecedents are is demonstrated by perhaps the greatest short and poignant statement about the brutality of the Stalinist regime, which had its roots in Lenin's dictum that the innocent should be persecuted in order to create sheer terror in the population. I am referring to Alexander Solzhenitsyn's spare novel One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, which chronicles the hour-by-hour experience of an inmate in a Soviet labor camp. Those who'd come to the end of their time had all been kept in pending further orders. So people originally sentenced to 3 years did 5 altogether. They could twist the law any way they liked. When your 10 years were up, they could say good, have another 10. Or pack you off to some godforsaken place of exile. Thus does Solzhenitsyn casually reveal how the whole edifice of communist ideology rested on utter cynicism. For this is a world where the cracking of one's boots near a fire could doom a man to death in the Siberian winter when the authorities would not give a man a new pair until spring. 10. Such malice and brutality against innocence rendered the individual utterly meaningless in what for the Soviets was the essentialist struggle between nations and ethnic groups, something that has defined Russian actions through much of history and is a tradition that Putin is heir to. Likewise, wanton destruction and abject cruelty, the bedfellows of indiscipline, combined with bad morale and an historical legacy of seeing flesh and blood individuals as mere abstractions that could be wiped off a blackboard, were distinct features of the Russian military in Ukraine, where, as in Stalin's day, cynicism ruled. Whatever social and political decline has occurred in the United States following the end of the Cold War, the Ukraine War showed Russia, especially as revealed by its war machine, to be in a far more advanced state of rot. The two situations simply cannot be compared. After all, large-scale warfare, with its emphasis, as we know, on materiel, logistics, and social organization, can provide an audit of an entire culture and civilization. In fact, Russian society may actually in some respects have gone backward since the end of the Cold War, since the performance of its military in Afghanistan in the 1980s could arguably be construed as better than in Ukraine. What defeated the Soviet Union in Afghanistan was not really the performance of its troops and logistics, but the sheer task of bringing control and order to an underdeveloped society situated on a sprawling and mountainous landscape. The Soviet military was misused in Afghanistan in a similar way that the US military was misused in both Afghanistan and Iraq. Yes, wars can be audits of whole societies. And warfare showed that Russia in 2022 through 2024 may indeed have gone backward since the days of the old Soviet Union. A Russian victory in Ukraine can only come about through the sheer, brutal application of fresh troops and materiel. Thus, whereas American politics have struggled to find a new normal after decades of harsh political division, Russian politics, to judge from the audit of the Ukraine war, require rebuilding almost from scratch. In Ukraine, by the end of 2023, Russia had already lost 2,200 out of 3,500 tanks and 315,000 out of 360,000 troops, forcing them to launch recruitment campaigns and raid the prison system. It is as if the entire third of a century since the collapse of the Soviet Union, followed by Boris Yeltsin's shambolic democracy, and then by Putin's more disciplined tyranny, constituted a false start, necessitating another new beginning, as though it were 1991 all over again. What only the passage of time could reveal in its true enormity was how Russian political culture had been so deformed and debased by the long, morally destructive decades of communism and especially Stalinism that only a replica of sorts, in this case Putin's style of rule, whose bedrock was utter cynicism much in the tradition of Lenin and Stalin, was possible in the aftermath. To be sure, Vladimir Putin's tyranny demonstrated that the problems of communism persist in Russia well into the third decade of the 21st century. In a way, we were all naive about communism when the Cold War ended, assuming automatically that Russia and former communist Central and Eastern Europe could simply cast off their chains and be free. Indeed, Central Europe, which had had a middle-class tradition prior to 44 years of communism, had much better prospects than Russia itself, which was largely without such a tradition and had suffered more than 7 decades of communism. The re-emergence of a Leninist level of cynicism in the form of Putin's rule, following the chaos of the 1990s, was actually foreseen, albeit indirectly, by the late policy intellectual and former ambassador to the United Nations Jean J. Kirkpatrick, in her historic and seminal essay Dictatorships and Double Standards, published in the November 1979 issue of Commentary. It is worth spending some time with Kirkpatrick's essay in order to comprehend what we are still up against. The foreign policy follies of the Carter administration were what motivated Kirkpatrick to write her essay. She gets to the point in the first sentence, "The failure of the Carter administration's foreign policy is now clear to everyone except its architects, and even they must entertain certain doubts." The problem, she says, is that President Jimmy Carter behaves like a man who abhors only right-wing autocrats, not left-wing ones. And it is the latter, who she defines as revolutionary, who are the real problem. Only intellectual fashion and the tyranny of right/left thinking prevent intelligent men of goodwill from perceiving the facts that traditional authoritarian governments, that is, right-wing ones, are less repressive than revolutionary left-wing autocracies, that they are more susceptible of liberalization, and that they are more compatible with U.S. interests. She goes on, and here it is worth quoting her at length. "Traditional autocrats leave in place existing allocations of wealth, power, status, and other resources which in most traditional societies favor an affluent few and maintain masses in poverty. But they worship traditional gods and observe traditional taboos. They do not disturb the habitual rhythms of work and leisure, habitual places of residence, habitual patterns of family and personal relations. But," she continues, "precisely the opposite is true of revolutionary communist regimes. They create refugees by the million because they claim jurisdiction over the whole life of society and make demands for change that so violate internalized values and habits that inhabitants flee by the tens of thousands in the remarkable expectation that their attitudes, values, and goals will fit better in a foreign country than in their native land." Because Kirkpatrick is writing in the late 1970s, her sights are set on the communist regimes of Asia, particularly Indochina, whose rule sent whole populations into exile. She is also defending the right-wing Somoza regime in Nicaragua and the Shah of Iran, who, despite all their faults, did not seek to reform their societies in the light of any abstract idea of social justice or political virtue. As we now know, the Nicaraguan Marxists who followed Somoza and the Iranian Ayatollahs who followed the Shah did exactly that, and so led their societies into far worse tyrannies, proving Kirkpatrick right. Kirkpatrick was an original thinker because her philosophy was both realist and neoconservative, which are usually opposed to each other. She was a realist in the sense that she knew that throughout most of history autocracy has been the default option while democracy is problematic. To wit, in Great Britain, the journey from the Magna Carta to the Great Reform Bills took 7 centuries to traverse. The United States cannot generally be the midwife to democracy far away, she believed. She was a neoconservative during the Cold War because she felt, like President Ronald Reagan did, that the United States had to defeat communism, not simply coexist with it. Revolutionary communist regimes destroy societies utterly by removing all the layers of civic organizations between the regime at the top and the family at the bottom and thus repairing them, as she likely well understood, would be the project of decades. The debacles of the Yeltsin and Putin regimes in Russia, which followed communism, again prove her right. Thus, the enduring legacy of communism, with all of its cynicism, in our world today must be added to the deadly mix encompassing the dystopian uses of technology, the finite size of the earth, the ravages of climate change, the ends of both monarchy and empire, the fast-forward development of precision-guided weaponry as well as of artificial intelligence, and so forth. And this deadly mix also involves the pathologies of urbanization that I will describe in the third part of this book, all in all accounting for the permanent crisis, which, as we will see later on, approximates the inner logic of T.S. Eliot's poem The Waste Land, which will take on a new and deeper meaning as the years pass. Imagine, Putin had looked so powerful, well-nigh invincible, on the eve of his invasion of Ukraine on February 23, 2022, with his armies massed on three of Ukraine's borders, poised to advance. NATO at this moment was still divided, with the Germans and French adopting a softer approach than the Poles, Balts, and other Central and Eastern Europeans who actually share borders with Russia. And Russian natural gas was ruling the roost, as it had done for years. The memory of Putin's victories in the small wars of the turn of the 21st century was still fresh. Putin at this moment in time was grudgingly respected as a formidable tactician. His annexation of Crimea and military subversion of eastern Ukraine in 2014 were popular at home, even as they angered Western policy elites. But, like the wars in the Balkans in the 1990s, they did not pivotally engage larger American and European publics, so that we can say Putin got away with it here, too. History often rests on a pivot. It is not all about vast impersonal forces but often about the emotions of an individual leader. And such a choice as Putin had to make was binary in the extreme, even as he faced a situation on the ground in Ukraine that appeared murky and given to mysteries. Would the Ukrainians quickly surrender? Or would they fight back hard? Had Putin not invaded and instead negotiated Ukraine's neutrality from a position of strength, Russia would likely still be perceived as a daunting great power. But as he chose to send columns of tanks racing across the border, his army and the weaponry it carried, and the culture that both encapsulated, were quickly exposed as simply not of first world quality, and were thus at first easily countered by NATO's arms deliveries to the Ukrainians. In fact, what followed, given the fighting spirit of the Ukrainians and the tens of billions of dollars worth of military equipment that the Biden administration dispatched to Ukraine, was the greatest demonstration of American power since the first Gulf War of 1991, when the United States ejected Iraqi forces from Kuwait under President George H.W. Bush. Suddenly, America loomed like a giant over the hapless Russians, who would soon be throwing hundreds of thousands of raw, barely trained conscripts into battle to gain a few inches or feet of territory. Russia would recover, sure, and fight the Ukrainians to a standstill, and even outlast them. But would the Russian Empire, that is, Russia's profound influence in the North and Transcaucasus, in Central Asia, Siberia, and the Far East, ultimately be able to withstand the enormous diversion of resources to the Ukraine war? World War I changed the 20th century and the world because it went on for 4 years. Had it gone on for only a year, or maybe two, the destruction would have been mitigated, Lenin perhaps would not have come to power, and neither might Hitler later on. Thus, every extra month of continued fighting in Ukraine might affect Russia and its imperial project similarly, to say nothing of its effect on the world. In the decades prior to World War I, the European powers were preoccupied with the so-called Eastern Question, which was about how to respond to the slow-motion demise of the Ottoman Empire, whose cruelty was tempered only by incompetence. The same could be said about the Russians in Ukraine. And likewise, the Eastern Question may again be on the table, as the United States and Europe spend the years to come dealing with the demise or transformation of the Russian Empire. Once again, American decline was in relative terms subtle and qualitative, with both major political parties at times gravitating toward the extremes, with racial tensions periodically on the boil, with cultural standards in disarray, with the liberal arts that educate new generations of Americans threatened by ideology, and so forth. But Russia's civilizational decline was fundamental and quantitative. It simply had no usable institutions, no system of leadership replacement even. The state was a force of nature best to be avoided whenever possible. The initial failure of the army was obviously reflective of the whole Russian state in this regard, starting at the top where no one dared to tell Putin the truth. Which was the ultimate reason he had such a difficult time at the beginning achieving victory in Ukraine. That is the chief problem with authoritarian leaders. The very intimidating nature of their rule makes it difficult for subordinates to risk a confrontation with the boss, and thus the very anxious foresight based on unpleasant facts, precisely the facts required for difficult decisions, is harder than usual to come by. Authoritarian leaders like Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping are, to some extent, operating blind. And because of their enormous power over events, they endanger not just their own countries but the whole world as a consequence. Democracies can be undynamic, late to the party, and weak in decision-making. But in their consultative ways they have generally less of a capacity for outright blunders than authoritarians do. Yes, the democratically elected younger Bush invaded Iraq. But Putin committed the larger blunder of invading Ukraine, Stalin decimated his officer corps before World War II, and Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. The list of self-defeating blunders made by dictators is much longer than those of Democrats. A world where major powers are governed by authoritarians is, therefore, that much more unstable. Authoritarians ruling Russia, China, Iran, and so on are another element of our permanent crisis. They provide order, but of an extremely uncertain kind. Putin's eventual downfall will more likely lead to anarchy than to stable democracy, or more likely to a messy and ill-defined political situation in Russia. We should keep Russia's semi-anarchic situation in the 1990s in mind given what may follow in the coming years. The perils of post-autocracy are real. Like empires, autocrats often arise out of chaos but also leave chaos in their wake. Communism, which as a morally debased political culture continued in spirit unabated under Putin, has left no sustainable institutions to work within. Because Jean Kirkpatrick's analysis of the difference between right and left-wing dictatorships was correct, and has admirably stood the test of time, we must be patient regarding Russia. As Daniel Patrick Moynihan reminded us, the central conservative truth is the preeminence of culture, not politics, in determining the success of a society. In Russia's case, the damage of over a century of extreme misrule on the culture will not be wiped clean in a week or a year even. To repeat, just as 19th century European diplomats faced the Eastern question brought about by the weakening of Ottoman Turkey, 21st century Western diplomats will face the Eurasian question, brought about by the potential weakening and tumultuous transition of Russia. In addition to Russian and American decline, there is also the Chinese variety. For decades China often seemed invincible to Americans, the very engine of economic and technological growth that has transformed both itself and the world. No nation in recorded economic history has improved the standard of living and the quality of life of so many people as quickly as China has under the extraordinary rule of Deng Xiaoping and his immediate successors. Deng has often been underrated in the West. When the last century ended, American pundits and intellectuals were divided over whether Winston Churchill, Franklin D. Roosevelt, or Albert Einstein was the greatest man of the past 100 years. The name of Deng Xiaoping, China's ruler, official, and de facto, from the mid-1970s to the early 1990s, was barely mentioned. That reflected a classic Western mindset, concerned with its own historical experience rather than with that of others, and which sees freedom in political and philosophical terms more than in social and economic terms. But given what is relevant for our own tune, a time of instability, destructive populism, intemperate dictatorships, and anarchy in places, in light of the struggles of silent billions across the planet who worry about putting enough food on the table and providing safety for their families more than they worry about the right to vote, Deng's accomplishment is the greater. Deng is what is missing in today's global environment. The absence of his likeness contributes to the permanent crisis. It may be too much to expect that great powers like China and Russia be both stable and democratic. It would be enough that they be stable and ruled by leaders who are both enlightened and bureaucratically competent. Therefore, I want to spend some time with Harvard professor Ezra Vogel's magisterial biography of Deng Xiaoping, who more than any other man was the father of the original Asian economic miracle, and whose story reads as though taken from the pages of Plutarch's Lives of the Noble Greeks and Romans. Deng took over China in the shadow of Mao Zedong. Mao had left China a social, institutional, and economic wreck. The country of 1 billion people at the time had been plunged into chaos. Universities had closed. Educated youth were forced into rural exile, even as the cities had no jobs for them. Soldiers and party cadres with no bureaucratic experience controlled the ministries. 80% of the population lived on $40 per year. This all constituted the immediate aftermath of Mao's great proletarian cultural revolution. Enter Deng Xiaoping. Ezra Vogel writes that some Westerners were so impressed with Deng's directness and pragmatism that they mistakenly thought he was a capitalist at heart and that he would lead China toward a Western-style democracy. But Deng knew better what was good for China, and it was not capitalism and democracy, according to Vogel. In the process, stepping stone by stepping stone, he guided the transformation of China into a country that was scarcely recognizable from the one he had inherited in 1978. At first, Deng rebuilt the Communist Party from the chaos of the Cultural Revolution because he knew that only the Communist Party, with all of its faults, could provide order at that moment. The Americans had applied this lesson when they granted amnesty to the rank and file of the Nazi Party in occupied Germany after World War II in order to get Germany back on its feet, but forgot it when they completely disbanded the Baath Party in Iraq following the occupation of that country in 2003. Deng's good sense was a product of his life experience. In his mid-twenties, in Guangxi, in south-central China, he led communist troops and militia in pitched battles against nationalists. He experienced the death of his wife and infant child on account of a miscarriage during feverish conditions in a local hospital. He then fought the Japanese invaders, and decided on executions during intense factional infighting. He struggled to construct a political order in his patch of ground rather than make an existing one less oppressive only to be purged by Mao and endure hard labor and re-education in the provinces. During the Cultural Revolution, Deng Piufang, Deng's son by his third wife, was paralyzed by falling from a third-floor window while being tortured by Red Guards. Deng resolved to keep praising Mao and keep him on a pedestal, but to bravely adapt party strategy to new and changing conditions. In the mid-1970s, while in the process of achieving power, Deng took the military out of party positions and returned it to the barracks. He promoted cadres based on talent and competence rather than on ideology. He knew that stability preceded modernization, and did his best to undermine hero worship, hardline ideology, and mass mobilization, the very opposite of Mao and China's current ruler, Xi Jinping. Deng would not tolerate the cult of personality that Mao happily indulged in, writes Vogel. Virtually no statues of Deng were placed in public buildings and virtually no pictures of him hung in homes. 14. Deng's crucial decision, which has determined his status as a great historical figure, was his introduction of elements of capitalism into communist China gradually, rather than through shock therapy as the Russians under American guidance attempted. He knew, writes Vogel, that China did not have the experience, rules, knowledgeable entrepreneurs, or private capital needed to convert suddenly to a market economy. 15. Because Deng lived in constant fear of chaos, he managed to avoid it, while reinventing China at the same time. He was in his own way a Burkean conservative, seeking the preservation of existing systems and values while concomitantly forcing them to evolve. He opted for gradual economic change and chose party reform, with term limits, over the introduction of democracy. Thus did China become a role model for the developing world. Nevertheless, Deng, at 84, remained the final decision-maker in the government crackdown against student-led demonstrations at Tiananmen Square in June 1989, when hundreds if not thousands were killed. The students had wanted more sudden, democratic change. Yet, as Vogel notes, in the two decades after Tiananmen, China enjoyed relative stability, and rapid even spectacular economic growth. China's trade with the world increased 100-fold, and 1.4 million young Chinese went abroad to study. Much of that was either under Deng or the result of policies that Deng had put in place. And much of that, too, was in the wake of Tiananmen, not before. The difference between the world's situation then and now, and between U.S. China relations then and now, is the difference between Deng Xiaoping and Xi Jinping. Deng, in keeping with his concentration on developing the Chinese economy and improving the daily life of average Chinese citizens, did not provoke tensions abroad, preferring trade to conflict, unlike Xi. The world has become what it is to a significant extent because we have autocrats like Xi and Putin holding sway rather than Deng and Gorbachev. The last decades of the 20th century were eras of hope in American-Chinese relations because they coincided with the era of Deng and his like-minded successors. As for the decline in U.S. presidential leadership, it has been real, but minor, compared to the decline in Chinese and Russian leadership, where pragmatism has given way to Leninist ideology in Beijing and to great Russian imperialism in Moscow. Xi Jinping is nothing if not a Leninist ideologue, who has made struggle the guiding principle of the Chinese Communist Party. In speeches to top party leaders that were kept secret for months before being released in Chinese, Xi denounced the fall of the Soviet Union, and said that to dismiss Lenin and Stalin is to engage in historic nihilism, it confuses our thoughts and undermines the party's organization on all levels. Xi has lamented the failure of the 1991 attempt by Soviet hardliners to topple Mikhail Gorbachev, nobody was man enough to stand up and resist. Xi goes on, facts have repeatedly told us that Marx and Engels' analysis of the basic contradiction of capitalist society is not outdated, nor is the historical materialist view that capitalism will inevitably perish and socialism will inevitably triumph outdated. For Xi, absolute power and absolute commitment to Leninist ideology with its focus on pure dictatorship in a one-party state is not enough. To punctuate his return of China to pure Maoist principles, derivative of Lenin, someone very prominent had to be publicly humiliated in a dramatic fashion in order to drive the point home. Thus, Xi's consolidation of power at the Communist Party Congress in October 2022 in Beijing was accomplished with a cruel personal twist. Hu Jintao, Xi's predecessor as president and the previous boss of China, seated next to Xi, appeared to be forcibly removed from the closing session of the Congress by two attendants and perp walked before the television cameras. Hu was the last in the line of moderate and pragmatic party leaders stemming from Deng. And his involuntary departure from the hall symbolized the end of an era, and signaled that the world would be more dangerous going forward. Indeed, Xi emerged from the party congress with a grip on power unrivaled since Mao. And thus his ability to make big mistakes that could shake the world is also unrivaled. His decision not to import foreign vaccines, coupled with China's sudden exit from a zero-COVID regimen, could still have serious international health consequences. His drive for state control will produce arbitrary economic decisions and policy instability, affecting us all, according to Eurasia Group, a New York-based risk consultancy. Vladimir Putin gave us the Ukraine war. We should be wary of Xi Jinping giving the world something perhaps just as deadly in China's own, highly sophisticated way. For China operates at a higher level than did Russia or the former Soviet Union. Whereas during the Cold War the Soviet Union represented a credible adversary in niche capacities only nuclear weapons, conventional land warfare, manned space exploration, China competes credibly with America across the board. China is a full-spectrum economic and military power with a vast First World Navy, nuclear weapons, a strengthening NCO Corps, and cyber and digital capacities that carry over from the military to the consumer sphere. China is preparing to send a man to the moon. Its efficient assembly line workers manufacture many of the sophisticated electronics that America and the world take for granted. Because of all these successes, and because of its somewhat opaque authoritarianism, China's political stability has been for too long taken for granted. But China, like the United States and Russia, though in varying degrees, is in decline. As we know, the rules of Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, and Hu Jintao signified a relatively progressive, enlightened, and collegial authoritarianism that Americans and Europeans, particularly Western businessmen, were comfortable with. This period saw China at the peak of its soft power, to say nothing of its hard power, as China had friends in Washington, not only in the business community but actually in the media, Congress, and the White House as well. But, this comfort/bonhomie belies the fact that Xi Jinping has returned China to the die-hard authoritarianism, bordering on totalitarianism, associated with Mao Zedong. As a consequence, China has lost almost all its friends in Washington. While this has been happening, China's annual economic growth has been slowing from double digits down to single digits, and finally perhaps to low single digits. Capital has fled the country, with foreign investors selling many billions of dollars in Chinese bonds and billions more in Chinese stocks. At the same time that China's economy has matured and investment from abroad has diminished, its population has aged and its workforce has shrunk, with reduced economic growth the consequence. Moreover, by directing economic activity and decision-making increasingly to the state, Xi Jinping, according to Kevin Rudd, the global president of the Asia Society, has been strangling the goose that for almost four decades has laid the golden egg. 18 And as China's declining economy leads to more social and political tensions, look at the demonstrations in late 2022 against the COVID-19 lockdown. The default option for its leaders may well be a greater dose of self-righteous nationalism and foreign policy assertiveness. Keep in mind that the Pentagon projects China will have at least 1,000 nuclear weapons by the end of the decade. 9 Thus, here as in Russia, the problems of communism are still with us, and as a consequence, military tensions remain high in the Western Pacific. To wit, Japan will be increasing its defense budget by over 9% in coming years, as well as acquiring hundreds of advanced missiles that can reach far into China and North Korea, which Japan now sees as active threats. The Japanese are particularly alarmed by the prospect of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which is close to their own Ryukyu Islands. Meanwhile, as Xi's China has forced Japan out of its pacifist shell and made it further enlarge its already robust navy and air force, the United States, Great Britain, and Australia have embarked on a military-industrial policy to provide Australia with nuclear-powered submarines that it can operate close to China. Just as Britain has served since before World War II as a geopolitical platform for the United States close to mainland Europe, Australia, situated at the confluence of the Pacific and Indian Oceans, will henceforth do the same for the Indo-Pacific region close to mainland China. This new, de facto Anglo-Saxon alliance effectively joins NATO to the Indo-Pacific through Great Britain, and specifically links NATO to the Quad, the Indo-Pacific alliance of democracies that includes Japan and India as well as the United States and Australia. This, again, is an example of the destabilizing effect of a finite Earth as military alliance systems now operate as a unified whole in both hemispheres, and on both ends of the Eurasian supercontinent. Whereas in World War II, the European and Pacific theaters were more or less separate, in the 21st century the linkages between the two theaters will be much more organic, as Europe itself is becoming more of a player in Pacific defense, in addition to its robust economic links with China. The globe is becoming the worst of both worlds, a unified theater of conflict, but one where each far-flung extremity of that theater can tweak the other end thousands of miles away and cause an eruption. This new Cold War between the United States and China is not likely to end for the foreseeable future, barring some unforeseen development. The United States and China are at odds on several major fronts. The Chinese military sees the South and East China Seas as its home territory, the blue water extensions of its continental landmass, much as the Americans saw the Caribbean in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. On the other hand, the U.S. military sees the Western Pacific as its home waters, too, believing that the United States is an Asian power going all the way back to the 1853 opening of Japan, the Philippine War at the turn of the 20th century, World War II in the Pacific, Korea, and Vietnam. The cyber age only makes this conflict more tense, as the enemy is now one click away rather than thousands of miles away, with the ability of a computer to wreak destruction from afar. The Chinese have already launched major hacking operations against the Pentagon and the U.S. Navy. A future war in the Pacific would be a contest of computerized and artificial intelligence-driven weapons systems linking warships and outer space. Then there is trade, where the two countries are in a tense competition, even as they cooperate. Perhaps never before in modern history have two major powers been on the brink of conflict yet so entangled in mutually beneficial economic relations. This is the biggest factor distinguishing the present Cold War from the one with the Soviet Union, which essentially had no trading and manufacturing economy. And it is also intrinsic to an era of globalization and regionalization on a finite Earth, in which states are tightly interlinked on multiple levels, even as they compete. Finally, there is ideology, which we have covered by comparing Deng Xiaoping with Xi Jinping. When China was led by more moderate leaders, there was still a profound difference between its system and our own democratic one. But now under Xi's totalitarianism the difference between it and the United States is that much harder, there is a total philosophical clash of systems of governance. And with that comes mutual animosity and suspicion, in which every dispute is imagined as existential. The best that can be hoped for in this Cold War between the United States and China is a condition akin to that after the Cuban Missile Crisis. During the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, both superpowers stared into the abyss, palpably seeing the possibility of all-out nuclear war. Because such a specter completely terrified them, they henceforth stepped back, and over the coming years established a hotline between the American and Soviet leaders, designed to facilitate communication, and initialed various kinds of treaties meant to limit the possibility of nuclear conflict, all of which culminated in détente. The issues of the Cold War weren't solved, but rules of the road were built around them. This happened even as the Soviet Union had quietly begun to decline, though few were then aware of it. China, too, is in decline, with a population aging at faster rate than America's, it is shrinking, actually, and with its complex economy directed by Marxist-Leninist ideologues. Because all three great powers Russia, China, and the United States are in decline, though in different ways and at different rates, it may be that the United States, which maintains the capacity for democratic renewal, has a comparative advantage over the two authoritarian powers, despite its soaring deficit. It is also important to realize that each great power, again in its own way, is an imperial one. Russian historical imperialism, going back to the conquests of the Romanov dynasty, was obviously evident in Ukraine. Chinese historical imperialism, going back at least to the conquest of the Qing dynasty, is evident in its longing to rule Taiwan. As for the United States, since the end of World War II, given its globe-spanning economic and military power, it has been an empire in all but name. Thus, the decline of the great powers signals another death knell for the stabilizing virtues of imperialism and the relative political order it brings, which go back to the dawn of history. However out of fashion imperialism has been since the second half of the 20th century. But, because the declines of the three great powers are relative to one another, there will be twists and turns in this process. For example, because Russia is declining at a faster rate than China, China's leverage over Russia has increased. This has led to Russia becoming a sphere of Chinese influence, as China extracts hydrocarbons from Russia at bargain basement prices, overwhelms Russian influence in former Soviet Central Asia, and so forth. China, in other words, because of Russia's weakening position, has gone from being a Pacific and Asian power to becoming a Eurasian one. For most of history, the supercontinent of Eurasia was too big to have any graspable meaning. But as I wrote in The Revenge of Geography, 2012, and The Return of Marco Polo's World, 2018, the very shrinkage of the Earth through geography has created a situation where Eurasia is suddenly imaginable in geopolitical terms. China's emergence as a Eurasian power, encompassing Russia, is only an early sign of this. 21. Once more, empires arise out of chaos, but their weakening and dissolution give way to new forms of chaos. History grants no solution to this dilemma. Imperial decline can take years, decades, or even centuries, all the while leading to regional turmoil and other pathologies. The Ottoman Empire was famously the sick man of Europe throughout much of the 19th and early 20th centuries, culminating in the Balkan Wars, World War I, and the Greco-Turkish War. Because the decline of imperial powers can mean more aggression on their part, as they become more insecure and desperate, even as there is increased chaos in their shadow lands, global geopolitics will become more tumultuous, not less. To use a financial term, we will for the foreseeable future be in a geopolitical bear market. Let me emphasize, the second and third order effects of great power decline, however gradual and uneven, will mean more outrages in the developing world and in the international system. Areas previously thought of as relatively stable will become less so. Disequilibria everywhere will intensify. Europe's stability will continue to be undermined by Russia. A post-Putin age in Moscow could be just as dangerous as the current condition. Russia is a weakly institutionalized state, especially compared to China, in which a form of anarchy could easily follow Putin. In terms of potential disarray, Russia might even become a low-calorie version of the former Yugoslavia, a crumbling state with enough nuclear weapons to destroy the United States in 30 minutes. There is no agreed-upon procedure to replace Putin, unlike in China, where the Communist Party has a procedure to replace Xi should he become incapacitated. Putin himself will have to rule until his death to be safe, and that was the situation even before he invaded Ukraine. Putin is at the center of several branches and circles of oligarchs and military and intelligence strongmen, who have all relied on him for their power and positions. That is the true extent of Russia's executive branch. Thus, a stable democracy is not the base case scenario for Russia after Putin. The base case scenario is something akin to a militarist nationalist regime, or a democracy too incoherent to be able to actually govern. That will lead to more anarchy and instability in the weakly institutionalized regions of the Russian Empire, even as China gains a stronger foothold there. Because such places are not in the forefront of the minds of the Washington and New York elites, they will pay it little heed, even as they proclaim an age of democracy because of the eventual rebuilding of post-war Ukraine. A victorious, post-war Ukraine would formally or informally be incorporated into NATO and the EU, bodily moving the original Atlantic Alliance with its economic equivalent eastward. Even under the best of circumstances, that would be a lot to digest for the bureaucrats in Brussels. Ukraine is a war-battered country of 44 million people with fragile institutions and a high level of corruption. Absorbing Iberia, Greece, and Turkey into NATO and Iberia and Greece into the EU were never easy challenges, nor was the later incorporation of former communist Central Europe and parts of the Balkans. In the mid and late 2020s, this enlarged and sprawling NATO and EU will be preoccupied with their newest member. And that will lead to informal constellations within those organizations. The bigger an organization becomes, often the more unwieldy and superficial it becomes, changing its very nature, as we have learned from many a corporate merger. NATO could informally divide into a more militant Poland-Ukraine-Romania axis, supported by Great Britain, and replicating the old intermarium, a 1920s concept meaning between the seas, the Baltic and Black Seas, that is a belt of states to guard against Russian expansion westward. Such a subdivision of NATO, which might weaken the alliance, overall, would compete with a more pacifistic France and Germany, while Sweden, Finland, and the three former Soviet Baltic states created their own nervous security system to guard against Russia, which even in a state of post-Putin weakness and disorder will be nuclear armed and dangerous, and with a long history of rebuilding its empire from bouts of chaos. Then there will be the Mediterranean countries of NATO and the EU, which will naturally concentrate on the problem of refugees and migrants coming from the higher birth rate areas of Africa and the Middle East through the course of the 21st century. The populations of Africa and the Middle East will increase from 1.7 billion people to 4.4 billion by the end of this century, while Europe's indigenous population rate remains stagnant. 22 in Africa, 95% of the labor force depends on informal employment, which is why tens of millions and more want to migrate northward. 23 No, Europe will not be altogether stable. It might turn out that along with long periods of the 19th century, Between the Napoleonic Wars and World War I, the Cold War division of the second half of the 20th century will continue to stand as Europe's most tranquil epoch. As for Asia, we know that its stability will be undermined by the shock effects of a rapidly arming, more nationalist and tumultuous China under Leninist rule. That will naturally mean higher defense budgets and greater naval activity throughout the Western Pacific and Indian Ocean. Such competition will be both abstract and alienating, as thousands of officers and sailors labor under grim lighting, conducting operations through computer screens inside gray-hulled warships, where war games are just as tense as live fire drills on land, as I can attest as an embedded journalist on destroyers and submarines. The chances of actual military conflict in the South and East China Seas will be quite small, but if it should happen, the consequences for financial markets will be severe, far more severe than the market reaction to the Ukraine and Middle East wars, as the world's three largest economies will be at loggerheads with high-end weaponry. Meanwhile, North Korea periodically threatens conflagration against not just South Korea, but against Japan and the United States, too, as deliverable nuclear weapons remain its best real defense against any attempts at regime change. The Middle East will continue in its struggle to create regimes, democratic or not, that avoid tyranny on one hand and anarchy on the other. This will become more rather than less difficult as populations in the Middle East increase in absolute terms, even as the underground water table continues to gradually diminish. This losing battle could lead to environmental hard regimes, Hobbesian in nature, as exist in Egypt, whose autocratic and paranoid style is ultimately the result of it having no answers to the question of people versus natural resources, aggravated by climate change. Pakistan may be the most extreme example of this approaching phenomenon, an artificially conceived country where democracy has never worked amid resource scarcity, vast corruption, unruly shanty towns and megacities, and ethnic and sectarian strife, each category working against the others to create ungovernability. Of course, this more or less describes quite a number of sub-Saharan countries, too. We are told that because of Africa's relatively high population growth rate, along with its enlarging middle class, the 21st century will triumphantly be an African one. The fact that African countries fill the lower and lowest ranks of the United Nations Human Development Index for reasons directly related to such a high population growth rate is rarely mentioned. The bottom 10 countries on the index are all in sub-Saharan Africa. As I have said earlier, Africa will constitute 40% of the world population by 2100. We are indeed entering a world that will be vast yet claustrophobic, more reachable yet more intractable and complicated, and most important, less and less tempered by the great powers, which will have no solutions for many countries. Nevertheless, at the moment that I write, geopolitics has a very particular tendency. Let me explain. A worldwide, bipolar military conflict has begun. It will progress in stages, feature hot war in certain places for extended periods of time, and cold war in other places and times. It will be the organizing principle of geopolitics for a few years to come. It is not a clash of civilizations, as Samuel Huntington put it, but it is a clash of broad value systems, which, while having their roots in national cultures and age-old traditions, are essentially modern and postmodern in their origins. It is a bipolar struggle that fuses the global war on terrorism with great power conflict. Rather than the latter replacing the former as many had supposed would occur following the conclusion of our post-9/11 Mideast wars and Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine, the two dramas now run together as a result of the Gaza war and the mass casualty terror attacks it may yet spawn. One pole of this bipolar world features gangster states like Russia and North Korea, totalitarian states like China and, again, North Korea, a revolutionary and terrorist state like clerical Iran, with all of its proxies, and a movement that, as I shall explain, is at once age-old, industrial, and post-industrial, anti-Semitism. These are enemies more formidable and in ways more nihilistic than the old Soviet Union and Mao Zedong's China. The Soviet leaders, who, because they were in many cases survivors of World War II and Stalin's purges, were generally conservative and risk-averse in their actions. And when they weren't, like Nikita Khrushchev in the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, they paid the price by being ousted from power. Leonid Brezhnev's 1979 invasion of Afghanistan led eventually to the collapse of the Soviet system altogether. As for Mao, with all of his atrocities against his own people, he could be a rational actor in foreign affairs, as the Nixon administration demonstrated. The current crop of villains constitute a more unstable, harder to predict human element than what we were used to dealing with during the Cold War. And these villains are all interlocked. Russia, through its Wagner mercenary group, threatened to send an air defense system to help the Iranian proxy Hezbollah fight Israel on the Israel-Lebanon border. Russia's new military alliance with Iran, which garners materiel and drones for Moscow in its war against Ukraine, makes President Vladimir Putin a de facto ally of Iranian Supreme Leader Ali Khomeini against Israel. North Korea is also sending arms to Russia, which helps Russia in its invasion of Ukraine, even as China backs Russia and benefits from the distraction of Hamas's attack on Israel. This is how the Ukraine and Gaza wars are connected. In all of this, we should be careful how we label our own side. Our side would be wrongly labeled as the world of democracies, not only because something such as anti-Semitism has rooted itself inside democracies themselves, witness our university campuses, but because our own side also includes conservative autocracies such as the regimes in the Arabian Gulf, Jordan, Egypt, and elsewhere, which stand for the regional status quo, as opposed to the revolutionary chaos that a regime like Iran threatens to bring about. In fact, this is a bipolar struggle between status quo powers like ourselves and leaders and movements that want to topple the existing post-Cold War order, whether by territorial acquisition like Russia in Ukraine, or like China in regard to Taiwan, or by the eradication of an entire people, the goal of Iran's coalition regarding Israel. Order versus disorder. That is what it's about. World War II was similar, since the Nazis and Japanese fascists attempted to replace an orderly world, with all of its faults, with revolutionary mass murder, military conquest, and extremism. Our Cold War adversaries were cautious by comparison. In geopolitical terms, the struggle is also between the Eurasian heartland powers of Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, and the Rimland powers that are essentially maritime, with some variations, such as the United States, Europe, Ukraine, Israel, and the conservative Sunni Arab powers from the Gulf to the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. These are geographical distinctions about which I wrote at length in The Revenge of Geography. But I must admit, given how technology has compressed geography, creating through digital media a global platform for performance politics, this is better understood as a war of ideas with geopolitical and military ramifications. The Heartland and Rimland divisions just don't capture the flavor of what is happening. Anti-Semitism does, since in its latest iteration it has been ignited by the war between Israel and Gaza and has since spread throughout the West, to the Russian Empire, and to China. Witness the pogrom-like riot in the Russian Republic of Dagestan in response to the arrival of a flight from Israel, and the attacks on Jews in Chinese social media circles in the wake of Hamas's October 7, 2023, attack. Anti-Semitism is a word with deep historical associations. It conjures up hatred of Jews in medieval Europe and pogroms against Jews in Russia's Pale of Settlement before and around the turn of the 20th century, and, of course, it culminates in the Nazi Holocaust in the mid-20th century. The Holocaust, in particular, gave anti-Semitism an industrial age aura, with converging railway tracks as a signature of both the industrial age and of trains transporting Jews to death camps. But anti-Semitism can be post-industrial, too, with its own new associations, even when wrapped around a territorial dispute between Israelis and Palestinians, as when Hamas terrorists used GoPro cameras to record their slaughter of Jewish women, children, and elderly people on October 7. That was nihilism, violent Jew hatred, postmodern performance politics, and Iranian grand strategy all at once, with clear-cut benefits to Russia and China. Israel stands at the heart of this global geopolitical war. That is because Israel hasn't really wavered. Israelis, not the Biden administration, giving the Ukrainians just enough aid and weaponry to wear down the Russians, but not enough to win outright. It is not Chinese President Xi Jinping biding his time about if and when to make a dramatic move to undermine Taiwan's de facto independence. It is not even Iran, which possibly seeks all the benefits of being a threshold nuclear power without actually using a bomb. Israel, although its population may be divided on many issues, is absolutely united about the need to militarily defend its territory, to defeat Hamas, and to neutralize Iran and its proxies. Ultimately, the shadow war between Israel and Iran, Israel's industrial sabotage, its assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists, may ignite into full-scale conflict with Israel frontally attacking Iran. I advance this theory mainly because the very intimacy and horror of October 7th, in which 1,200 Israelis were killed, tortured, raped, and kidnapped in the most hideous manner, may have shifted Israeli calculations about Iran, Hamas's principal backer, in a more decisive direction. Beyond this, many scenarios are possible. Keep in mind that clerical rule in Iran rests on an increasingly narrow base of support. Iran has been likened to a country of 85 million South Koreans ruled by a clique of North Koreans. Vast anti-government demonstrations, calling for the downfall of the Ayatollahs, occurred in 2022. And they were not the first. 2009, 2017, 2018, and 2019 also saw massive anti-regime uprisings. It is a long way from such large protests to true political upheaval. But it was massive protests that toppled the Shah's regime in 1979. We have to be able to imagine a post-revolutionary system in Iran, or at least the kind of instability that starts to immobilize the current power structure. An event from outside, such as a successful Israeli or Israeli-American attack on Iranian nuclear and missile facilities, may help to do just that. As for the Ukraine war, as I've said, it may just be a curtain raiser for ugly unrest elsewhere across the sprawling Russian Empire, where Siberian republics such as Bariatia and Tuva have provided troops for Ukraine, and have died in proportionally much greater numbers than ethnic Russians from places like Moscow and St. Petersburg. The Russian Empire, as this war in Ukraine grinds on, may be ready to start crumbling. And curiously, such a world will be less in consciousness as it plunges into the cross-currents of other consciousnesses and civilizations, nevertheless struggling to survive and both influence and direct all those colliding geopolitical forces mentioned above. Isolationism is the past, full immersion in a chaotic world is the inevitable future.